Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi has been sentenced to 4 years in jail for tax fraud. A court in Milan's also barred him from holding political office for 3 years. Dr. Jeff Andrews has written about post-Berlusconi Italy. He doubts he'll end up in prison.
I think this will finish off his political career. It will have implications, you know, for his business career as well. But I don't think anybody really thinks Berlusconi will go to jail. And most people believe that in the appeals processes that will go through, he'll find a way out.
A care firm embroiled in an abuse scandal in Bristol says it's brought in changes to stop anything similar from happening again. Six former employees at Winterbourne View have now been jailed and five given suspended sentences over so-called culture of cruelty against disabled patients. Lawyer Andrew Hannan represents some of the victims and their families.
Some of those family members have literally been driven to attempted suicide. They have been so hurt. They feel they've betrayed their family members by putting them into the care of Winterbourne View.
More homeowners are being hit by rising energy costs, this time from EDF. It's increasing gas and electricity prices for residential customers by 11% in December. A city trader who's accused of Britain's biggest fraud has broken down in court and denied gambling away £1.4 billion. Kwaku Adeboli, who worked at Swiss bank UBS, is accused of high-risk illegal trading to boost his bonuses and his job prospects. Cycling's governing body has announced it won't be awarding victories or upgrading positions to anyone involved in races affected by the Lance Armstrong doping scandal. And an Olympic bronze medal belonging to Team GB hockey player Hannah McLeod has been recovered. It went missing from a London nightclub on Tuesday. It was posted anonymously to England Hockey headquarters. That's the latest. I'm Kat Collins.
Hello, Bristol, and welcome to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and helping us review this week's news is Lib Dem councillor for Cotton and cabinet member for housing, Anthony Negus. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. In the second hour after six, we take a look at the little-known BBC radio drama Experiment in 1926, which broadcast a pretend revolution in London with sound effects of the House of Commons being blown up by a massive crowd of armed communists. We go back over the revelations of legendary documentary filmmaker Alan Frankovich and hear his eerie expose of CIA interference in Iran. Find out also why it's so relevant to today's events. And as ever, Martin Summers takes us on a tour of the world's hotspots. We also look at the local enterprise partnership. That's all in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, the two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, cool with light rain this weekend, and tomorrow will be cold and sunny. Quite different weather on Sunday, though. A little warmer, 10 Celsius, not much warmer, with some rain. Next week, Monday, Tuesday and Thursday, sunny periods. Wednesday and Friday, though, look like cloudy and rainy days. Next weekend, 3rd and 4th of November, down close to freezing with some light rain on Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So, helping us review this week's news is Councillor Anthony Negus from Cotton, who's also the council member, a cabinet member even, for housing. Hi, Anthony. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello there.
Now, first of all, Anthony, can you just tell us a bit about your role in housing on the City Council's cabinet? What does it entail?
Well, apart from housing, I've also got property and regeneration, but housing, the housing aspect of it covers absolutely everything, in fact, from private housing right the way through to council housing and homelessness, all aspects to do with housing in general.
Now, when you say private housing, one would think that, well, you know, I can imagine Anthony is responsible for the big blocks of council houses, but not for individual people's private homes, surely?
No, but it comes into play, for example, when we're dealing with development, where out of a planning permission comes the opportunity for affordable housing, as on the back of a Section 106 agreement. So we do deal with private developers, and also increasingly where there are stalled sites at the moment, we're also involved with the Homes and Communities agencies in trying to unblock those stalled private sites, and they in turn also release affordable housing and other assets for the city. So obviously we have to keep an open mind about how we get involved in all of these things.
Now, one of the things that you always come across if you start delving into anything to do with planning and development is that term you use there, this Section 106 agreement. Now, I mean, the risk of boring people, can you just, you know, in a nutshell explain what is a Section 106 agreement?
Well, people won't need to know about it too much longer. It was a device which comes in on the back of a planning application where the city council can do a deal with developers whereby they get advantages back to the city council to mitigate the disadvantages they get from actually having a development. So in very easy terms, it might be things like road improvements, it might be tree planting, it might be a pedestrian crossing, it might be all sorts of things like that. But also increasingly recently, it's become things like contributions to education, because obviously we have to provide school places for the children that will live in the new development, and it also tries to achieve affordable housing coming out of the private housing in the development. But, and there's a but here, on January the 1st, the Section 106 changes under government legislation to another set of letters called CIL, the Community Infrastructure Levy, and that's really a different way of dealing with what used to be Section 106. I won't go into all the details, but it's another way of providing the infrastructure that you need to maintain the planning permissions granted.
So, I mean, in a nutshell, it's really the fact that when planning permission is granted for a big development of some sort, that this can be a real bumper money earner for the developer. And it's the idea being that the council then extracts some of that value as something which is a good for the community.
That's right.
Well, it could also be possibly...
That was a little quicker than the way I said it.
Could actually be possibly construed as a bribe, Anthony. You know, you're saying, well, look, you know, you give us this and we'll give you that.
No, even it's a deal.
Even if the
it's a deal.
You know, the development isn't necessarily appropriate. I mean, we know how good these developers are, for example, at building supermarkets and that kind of thing. I mean, particularly out of town ones, which then leave to. I mean, if you go down to Shepton Mallet, you'll see the town of Shepton Mallet is dying because the developers are so good at getting their planning permission nowadays.
Well, I don't deal with Shepton Mallet, I'm pleased to say, but the deals that we set up, the list of things that we are looking to achieve in Bristol to mitigate the development, we can't just add on a long list of a wish list. It has to be to do with mitigating that particular development. That comes in pretty early, and negotiations start pretty early. So a bribe implies that... you won't get the planning permission unless you actually do what we say. It isn't like that. It is a negotiated deal.
Well, there's been all these negotiations going on over the last few weeks to do with the Bristol General Hospital development, and I did try and twist the arm of Alex Woodman, who's the chair of the Central Planning Committee, to come on, who's also a Liberal Democrat, to talk a bit about that. But can you take us through that a little, Anthony? Because it's going to be a lot of what effectively are luxury houses being built on that old public, what was public land, as a public hospital, the idea was that there were going to be something like 40% of those flats were going to be affordable, that is to say a subsidised price, quite cheap, so that, you know, people on medium incomes might be able to afford them, but somehow the deal has now fallen through with the threat by the city and country developers, and they've said, well, look, you know, unless we get zero affordable housing, we can do exactly what we want. We're just going to leave the General Hospital as a sort of derelict site until you give us permission for just what we want.
Well, I know this programme is only an hour long, so I'm going to try and be as brief and as sharp as I can. The original intention, the original shopping list, if you like, was certainly for 40% affordable housing, but we're very much also up against something which the previous administration on Bristol City Council brought in early 2009, and the government have recently endorsed, which is called a viability statement. In other words, the developers have to be able to prove or plead that the viability will or won't work with certain things that we want out of it as well. When we originally had the application in front of us for the General Hospital, the developer did a viability study, and we did a viability study at Bristol City Council, and they did not agree. And on the basis of analysis of those two studies, the Development Control Committee, which I am not a part, I have to say, I'm separate from that, took the view that that the viability was adequate to sustain a certain amount of affordable housing. It dropped it from 40%, but it certainly wanted some affordable housing out of that. What came out of that was then a further agreement that there would be an independent viability report done. So another one was done. That independent viability report tended to agree more with what the developer was saying. And as a result of that, under the viability rules, we were then... The Development Control Committee took it upon themselves to then reverse their decision and agree on the basis of that viability report.
Yeah, I can understand that, but I mean, it sort of seems to be a bit of a green light for developers, doesn't it? That kind of, because of the current situation, effectively, financially, with the recession, although we were told yesterday apparently we're out of recession now, so things might be looking up, but are you concerned that this is a bit of a green light for developers to go ahead with big developments and to actually go into those projects thinking that they can just do what they want with no affordable housing section?
Of course I am. The large, about 30% of the affordable housing that we got built in Bristol every year came out of private developments. It came out of what was then, or still is at the moment, the Section 106 agreements. And to lose that is to lose a massive amount of the affordable housing that was coming into the system. So of course I'm concerned.
Okay, I'm also joined by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, I'll pick up on the point we made just there. We're out of recession, we heard this week from the Chancellor George Osborne.
Well, I mean, we've had one quarter's figures, which supposedly show 1% growth. I don't think this is the end or even the beginning of the end. And I think it would be foolish for anybody to be complacent about this.
Yeah, but I mean, ultimately, it's good news, surely. I mean, it means that it's not actually, we're not in a double dip recession now. We're in a double dip and a double tip,
What could easily happen is we could get a triple dip recession, which is the first time that's ever happened. And the situation out there in the world at large, not just in Britain, is pretty bad. The possibility of a triple dip recession is still there, and we haven't had one of those before.
Well, one of the ingredients cited is the Olympics as was a big boost, apparently, into the current figures. So once that's kind of worked its way out through the system, what are the bigger macroeconomic signs, though, as to whether Britain is likely to move into the recovery situation? Sound like a patient, don't we? You know, sort of in the back of an ambulance or something. Are we going to recover or not?
Well, I think the risks are all on the downside. The euro crisis isn't over by any stretch of the imagination, so that could blow up at any time. The other thing that's a big factor, of course, is the US presidential election. And if, for example, Romney wins, they've already said that they intend to stop the stimulus policies that have been pursued by the Obama administration, half-hearted though they have been. So that's two potential negatives staring us straight in the face. China's slowing down, not that we sell much to China, we should be more concerned with Ireland than China, but I don't think anybody can be complacent about this situation. The economy is still smaller than it was a year ago and a lot smaller than it was 4 years ago, so you know, we're not out of the woods by any stretch.
Certainly not complacent, Martin, but if I may say so, it's a lot better than it might have been.
I agree.
Sorry, Anthony, can you just explain or expand your point there a little
well,
bit?
Well, we are looking at 1% rise after a period of very low figures. We might have this quarter had another set of very low figures. The fact is, we haven't got that. I don't believe that one swallow makes a summer, but it's at least better than it might have been, and it may allow us to look a little bit more brightly forward.
I mean, how does it affect your job, apart from what we've obviously been talking about with the General Hospital? If the economy is in a bad state, then it's difficult for developers to build and make enough money to build affordable housing for those that need that kind of housing. So, I mean, how does it generally affect, you know, your work in the city, Anthony?
Well, the overall
economy?
Well, despite what comes out of Westminster, which is that it's all the fault of local planning authorities and it's all the fault of the fact that there isn't enough land. In fact, 95% of the problem, and if you ask any house builder, they would tell you exactly the same, 95% of the problem is finance. Finance comes out of actually the ability to get finance, and that comes out of the confidence behind the people holding on to the finance. At the moment, the bankers have got very, very low reserves. The government is begging them to lend money, but on the other hand is also telling them that they must get the reserves to a decent state whereby they keep a proportion of their reserves in place before they start lending. So they're in a double bind anyway. What needs to happen is that the government need to release one of those anchors so that the banks can release more finance, so that firstly developers can start developing, can start getting the land together, can start getting the construction and design teams together. But secondly, so that the finance will also be released at the other end, so that those houses can be purchased through the normal mortgage system.
Yeah, I think that the situation, when you're talking about the banks, they're putting their reserves up. I think the banks basically are insolvent, and this is a fundamental problem which nobody's facing up to, and including that the Labour front bench.
I would say, Martin, that, you know, all this quantitative easing, not a lot of it seems to be being used by the banks to actually lend into the economy. It just seems to be being absorbed.
Well, it's being used to cover their bad bets in the derivatives market, and of course it isn't filtering through to developments like the ones that Anthony's working on.
Indeed, it isn't.
And I think the problem is that the banks can't be made to be have better reserves at the same time lend. I understand that contradiction, but the real contradiction, the problem, is that they're actually insolvent, and without state support they wouldn't exist. And ultimately, I'm afraid there is going to be a banking collapse, and after that we'll talk seriously about public investment for public good. But of course, at the moment, this is off the table and nobody can talk about it.
Well, I think that's a little bit, if I may say so, a little bit jaundiced. I think that we handle properly, we will see a steady resurrection of the financial system. But I think it's going to take a lot longer than people are saying. And quantitative easing is not putting liquidity back into the system. It's simply sort of lubricating some rather ponderous wheels, and I think it will have the effect in a couple of years' time of seeing interest rates rising as that as those bonds get back onto the market and change the rules.
Martin, that quantitative easing is certainly eroding people's pensions and people's savings, but what ponderous wheels is it oiling?
I think the transmission mechanism, as Anthony's pointing out, is not really there. Quantitative easing is essentially a stopgap measure to stop the banks from collapsing, and that's all it does, and it doesn't actually lead to anything else. I mean, I'm not predicting this because I'm a bad person or because I this is genuinely how I see it. We've had 4 years of the Obama administration and two administrations in this country, and we haven't actually tackled the financial system as it should have been tackled. And ultimately, markets work and the financial system will fail because it's broken. And I think all of us need to think about a plan B if that happens. And I'm not saying that it will happen, perhaps it won't, and perhaps it will just somehow sort itself out. But I'm not a believer in free markets. I never have been. I wasn't a believer in them under Margaret Thatcher or New Labour or now. I've never believed in them. I still don't.
Why is that?
Because they don't work. I mean, ultimately, you've got to have a mixed economy, which is a balance between the public and the private sectors, but we've forgotten all of that.
OK, Anthony, I'll give you the final word on this.
Well, I've just said yes. I think there has to be a mix between the public and the private sector, but even in the greatest example of public finance resurrecting an economy, which is the Roosevelt situation in the 30s, that still used the private sector. It introduced public capital back through the private sector, and I think the two have to work together in some way.
Okay, now on to another story, and the Jimmy Savile sex scandal at the BBC and with the police is rumbling on. 7 times, apparently, the police let Jimmy Savile off. That's the headlines of many of the newspapers today. But this was raised on Wednesday by Tom Watson in the House of Commons at Prime Minister's Questions. And if you listen carefully, you can hear a lot of the Conservative people at the very beginning, when Tom Watson stands up to speak, making sort of animal noises at him. But anyway, let's hear what he had to say.
Watson!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The evidence file used to convict paedophile Peter Wrighton, if it still exists, contains clear intelligence of a widespread paedophile ring. One of its members boasts of his links to a senior aide of a former Prime Minister, who says he could smuggle indecent images of children from abroad. The leads were not followed up, but if the files still exist, I want to ensure that the Metropolitan Police secure the evidence, re-examine it, and investigate clear intelligence suggesting a powerful paedophile network linked to Parliament and Number 10.
Well, the Honourable Gentleman raises a very difficult and complex case, and I'm not entirely sure which former Prime Minister he's referring to, but what I would like to do is look very carefully in Hansard as to the allegations that he's made, the case that he's raised, and look very carefully and see what the government can do to help give him the assurances that he seeks.
Well, Tom Watson certainly concentrated people's minds, and there were no animal noises at the end of that one. Martin, do you want to for your first thoughts on this whole business of this running story about the Jimmy Savile, and also potentially moving into other networks of paedophilia and abuse of young children, with the latest news that the police have said, actually 7 times, or the police haven't said this, but the newspapers are saying it, 7 times this guy has been let off from abusing children. That's the headline in the Sun today. So who's really to blame? Is it the BBC, the police, or who?
The abusers, let's be clear. This is obviously what happens in society, is that things which are tolerated in one generation are not tolerated in future generations, and that's how it should be. I mean, there's massive evidence of abuse going back to the 1950s and 1940s, and of course there was no child abuse in those days, at least people thought there wasn't, but of course there was. And as we become more aware of the dangers and the possibilities here, that's why we've changed all of the CRB checks.
Are you saying that it wasn't illegal in the 1960s
and 70s? It was illegal, but there was a culture, clearly in the Jimmy Savile case, there's a culture of tolerance, and looking back on it looks pretty sick. But I don't think this is a matter of party politics. It's a matter of basic decency, isn't it?
And what do you think of the way that the BBC Director General, who was at the Culture, Media and Sports Select Committee at the beginning of the week, his reaction to all this?
Well, I mean, Suzanne Moore writing in The Guardian, I had to agree with her. She's saying this isn't really about organisations, although it is about organisations and whether they have proper procedures in place for dealing with abuse. Clearly that's the case, whether it's the BBC or a sports club. But ultimately, we should be thinking about the victims. They are the people that this is about, and they've got to have justice.
Anthony?
Well, I think the only thing that does touch upon the Director General is what he's done while he's been in place, and what he's done is try to look at the separation between the actual abuse and how the Newsnight team responded when they had other things on their plate at the same time. That's clearly within his that's very much on his desk, because not only was he the Director General when he decided on those two investigations, but he was also in place when in another place, but nevertheless controlling that aspect of it, when Newsnight had to confront that situation of what they did with a valedictory thing for Jimmy Savile and also an investigation at the same time. So I think that he's in it. It's very much something that he has got to take responsibility for and to deal with under his watch. I think we have to understand in this situation what abuse means. We've all seen people putting their arms around somebody and all the rest, and I think that's abuse. Sometimes it's just friendliness. I don't know how far. We've not had the word abuse defined in terms of Jimmy Savile or indeed anybody else. It could well be an extreme situation. It could well be something that's less extreme, but happened very, very often. I think that's something we need to understand. But it still doesn't get over the fact that this is clearly wrongdoing. And it's been wrongdoing that's been covered up by the fact that somebody has some sort of cachet, some sort of particular aurora around them, which means that they can't be touched, or it's insensitive or commercially not the right thing to try and touch them. And that's something that no one should be beyond that. Everybody should be equal when it comes to the law, and certainly we must get to grips with this. I think it probably is far more endemic than one named person. I certainly, to actually cast the net as wide as the House of Commons and society in general, I really wouldn't have any credentials to answer that one. But I'm pretty sure that it's a lot more widespread than we think about, and I think we've got to address this. It's a very serious issue.
Well, we had Peter Rowell, didn't we, the BBC presenter who also worked on GWR radio here in Bristol. I mean, it certainly wasn't just Jimmy Savile. He was convicted, I think it was about 18 months ago, sent down for 6 years for, yeah. I mean, for example, there were girls phoning up his phone-in, and he was taking those numbers and then approaching them, telling them he was going to show them around his studio, and then literally abusing them whilst they were in there.
Yeah.
It's certainly not just limited to Savile. My problem, Martin, and I don't think you really addressed this at all, was the question, which was about this Newsnight report, which was spiked before Christmas, where reporters from Newsnight had actually interviewed people who had themselves been abused by Savile, and then Peter Rippon, who's the editor of Newsnight, told them that the story wasn't going to run. Now, there are all sorts of implications as to the impact on the BBC schedule, that kind of thing. So, I mean, what about decisions like that, about saying, well, we're not going to run this story, we're just going to put it on the back burner and forget about it?
Well, as Anthony pointed out, the BBC Director General is on the hook for that, and that needs to be looked into.
We still had no resignations, no sackings over that particular issue, have we?
Yeah, but you can't just willy-nilly sack people. You've got to have a proper investigation and prove exactly what the line of responsibility was, especially in very serious allegations like this. People are innocent till proven guilty.
Also, on to our next story, and there are candidates for the top police role now made official, as are the mayor candidates. The final final list of those was out on Tuesday. The mayor candidates are independent police and crime commissioner candidates Sue Mount Stevens and also Pete Levy, as well as John Savage for the Labour Party. Pete Levy that's standing for the Liberal Democrats, and Ken Maddock for the Conservatives. On this one, Anthony, without actually referring to your candidate, who's Mr. Levy, can you just tell us what you think about the change, overall change? change, going from a police authority to going to a role of one individual as a police and crime commissioner?
Oh dear. Well, you've touched the nerve, I'm afraid, because I sat on the police authority for the first year that I was a councillor. I don't go along with quangos, and certainly the police authority was a quango, but it did have the advantage that Avon and Somerset Police covers a very widespread area, and the 14 people that represented it on the police authority, who frankly were not paid very much, I have to say, nevertheless spread right the way round that police authority and were able to bring their own individual knowledge of their patch to bear on an overall decision as to the direction that the whole Avon and Somerset Police should move into. Now, obviously, I'm a Bristol councillor, and I am aware that the patch that covers Bristol is the only patch, and I think it's still true, it was certainly true while I was on the police authority, it's the only patch that is considered important enough to have an assistant chief constable running it. Still does have assistant chief constable John Long in charge of it. And I'm very concerned that any one individual, perhaps if particularly if they were out in the shires, would be able to bring particular experience to bear on how to deal with that patch that is Bristol. I think you know, the people that know that area very well will be able to deal with that, but those that don't know that area won't, and that concerns me. I mean, I'm very concerned about one person taking the responsibility for such a wide and disparate patch of a police authority. And so in that respect, I am concerned that it's now one person instead of 14, although I do understand that there's going to be a sub-tier of people that are sort of going to be scrutinising what that police commissioner does. And certain of the candidates, of course, have got police experience as well, and that's good. But it's in principle, I am concerned that this is going to be the right way forward, because I'm very worried. The police, Westminster has been trying for a long time to manipulate the police authorities. It's going to be very much more easy for them to manipulate 32 people instead of 32 times 14 people. And that concerns me.
Okay, you can't say that, Anthony, without me asking you to elaborate a little bit. In what way do you feel that the police authority has been manipulated? Because I think in Bristol, one of the running themes is, you know, we do feel that we can run things better ourselves without interference from Westminster.
Well, Westminster does have, and has shown, certainly over the last 2 or 3 years, that it's wanted to get more involved in the way that the police authority works. It's been bringing pressure to bear in the same way as it has with schools trying to make them into academies. It's been putting pressure on individual police forces to amalgamate and to do things in the way that Westminster would prefer. And I'm afraid I'm going to take a lot of convincing that having one person to put influence on, which is a police and crime commissioner, is it makes it much easier for Westminster to be able to pull those strings a little bit more tightly than it otherwise would have been able to with the police authority.
Well, the elections take place at the same time as the elections for Bristol's first elected mayor on the 15th of November. Martin, what do you make of this police and crime commissioner versus the old police authority business?
Well, I understand that the Liberal Democrat Party in Kidderminster refused to stand somebody for this role for exactly the reasons that Anthony's suggested, saying that this is actually, you know, we've got other things to do and more important things to do than stand people for this election.
One of the things that a lot of people have commented on is that in some cases the more extreme parties may be standing people, like, for example, the British National Party, this kind of thing.
Well, I mean, if you think about it for 2 seconds, we've spent 30 years in Northern Ireland trying to convince every section of the community that the police isn't on anybody's side and is above politics. And, of course, they're not introducing this in Northern Ireland. It's, they're copying what they do in Texas, but they should perhaps have looked at Belfast rather than Texas. Would it have been acceptable, for example, to have a police commissioner election in Belfast where the UDA stand against the IRA, which is effectively what would probably happen?
Well, that's amazing. So if it was happening in Belfast, you might have a Sinn Féin.
Well, no, you wouldn't, because what they've said, of course, the Labour candidate in Raven and Somerset was disqualified because they had a criminal record going back to 1948 for trespass.
For £5 fine.
Yeah, but I mean, in Northern Ireland, you wouldn't be able to say to Sinn Féin ex-prisoners that they couldn't stand for being police commissioner. It would break the deal that has been done in any case. But I think this is actually an idea copied from the United States and a poor idea. The police themselves are opposed to it. The Police Federation is opposed to it. Ian Blair, as the head of the Met, has encouraged people not to vote in the election, just as it were, the Liberal Democrats in Kidderminster have basically refused to participate. The danger is that you're going to get a turnout. The Electoral Reform Society thinks the turnout will be something like 18%. And on that, of that, that means that whoever wins will get 4, 5, 6%, and then they will have complete control of the police. And if you've got a Tory person running the Avon and Somerset police, and there's another riot in Bristol, for example, where there are contentious issues to be resolved and all the rest of it, how can a police commissioner with a 6% mandate from Somerset mediate that situation? They can't.
Anthony?
I'm not going to disagree with that.
Okay, all right, thank you. And the election, as I said, is on the 15th of November for the new Police and Crime Commissioners. And we will have, we hope, all four, certainly at least three of them, on this programme next week. We'll be talking to them about policing Avon and Somerset and what their intentions are and their priorities will be, because one of them will be the new Police and Crime Commissioner. Now on to Ford, and the Ford factory, the last one in Britain actually making vehicles, has closed. This is the Transit factory down in Southampton. Anthony, this is a bit of a tragedy, isn't it, in a way? Ford's been making vehicles in Britain for over 100 years, and this is the last one. It's going.
Well, apart from anything else, it's a personal tragedy for those people that have lost their jobs, which I feel very sad about. I mean, on a slightly sort of sideways note, those people that have been working for years and years and years down there are suddenly now going to become on benefits. And, a lot of people on benefits are abused by not in the same way as we used the word earlier, but certainly have a very bad press, and yet these people one day have been working for 25, 40 years or whatever it is down there. The next day they're on benefits and they become people that are accused of being taking the state's money and not working. And I think we've got to get a better view of what people on benefits are all about. You know, they're not scroungers necessarily. There are some that certainly have not worked, and we have generations of people not working. But the vast majority of people on benefits are people that want to work. And they're either not working because there simply isn't the work out there for them to do, or it actually is the way the benefit system is currently set up, it actually doesn't make it viable or make any common sense at all for them to go out to work for either a tiny increase in take-home money, or even in some cases a loss. So that aside, as far as Ford's concerned, what's very interesting is that this doesn't seem to be an economic decision. I mean, although Fords have been running, I believe, at Southampton at a very low ebb for some time. They've been working on one shift, so they've got a very large factory which is working unproductively. In terms of the actual cost to produce the goods, Britain is actually delivering extremely well. We have a very good efficiency and cost basis for that, compared with something like Germany, for example, which isn't being closed down, which is a lot more expensive to produce the same goods as Britain is. I think what's interesting is that the development side of Ford is still in there. They're still talking about developing a new diesel and a new petrol engine in this country, and we've still got this very large research establishment down in Essex, Which is looking to the future. And I think there's lots of things which we are doing in this country which are moving forward in terms of fuel efficiency and a general green resources and green technology, which I think is the way forward for this country. We're no longer, I fear, going to be in the market to be metal bashers. What we've got to be is far cleverer and earn our keep that way. And in view of what Ford have closed and what they've not closed, I think that might be a sign of the fact that Ford agree with me.
Well, there's 500 immediate staff to go at this plant. One of the interesting side effects of this, though, is, Martin, is that there's going to be, they believe, at least another 1,500 people lose their jobs who are dependent, you know, basically selling bits and pieces into this factory.
Subcontractors. Yeah, well, I mean, if we come back to the GNP figures, which have supposedly gone up by 1% in the last 3 months, looking at breaking those down, it's actually services and public spending, which actually accounts for the majority of that 1%. There's not been any increase in construction or manufacturing for export, which is presumably what we're talking about here. Now, taking another point that Anthony was raising earlier, benefits in a situation like this are crucial because they actually cushion Southampton from going down the drain if all these people got put on benefits. So a welfare state is not just a kind of fairness issue, it's also an efficiency issue. And a welfare state creates automatic stabilisers. So as people are put on the dole, they get proper benefits and they don't not kicked out of their houses and so on and so forth. Now, in actual fact, as we've seen, the deficit reduction programme of the government has slipped, and I would suggest that that's got an awful lot to do with the fact that the economy is not actually falling down a hole because they're not actually reaching their deficit reduction target. I think in actual fact the deficit reduction target was too tight, and the fact that they can't meet it because of the automatic stabilisers, as people get put on the dole, they go on as people get made redundant, they get put on the dole. There is still the makings of a welfare state in Britain which protects us from the worst effects of market changes like this. And I think basically that is the way to do it, and that's the way we've always done it. And I think we need to actually recognise that the welfare state is a functional part of the architecture.
But this Ford closure is indicative of something different, isn't it? It's indicative of a move away from Britain being a place where things are made. What we're doing is we're still buying and driving Fords around. It's just that none of them seems are made here at all now.
It may be that the demand for buying cars is not actually that great. This is what we're talking about at the beginning. There's not enough demand in the world economy to keep.
But there is enough. There is enough to keep other Ford plants going.
Well, no, but when one goes down, that means there's less being produced, Tony. I mean, the real problem is demand in the world economy. It's not a supply side problem. It's a demand problem. And if there's they go over the fiscal cliff in the US and the euro disintegrates, there just won't be enough demand in the world economy. And it's not a question, but the British government's policy is wrong in my view, but they'd still have to operate within a global context in which we've got a demand deficiency as a result of the financial disaster.
Well, our next story is related to this, and Anthony certainly brought up the connection with these 500 Ford workers and the 1,500 people who were working in other factories and other places supporting that plant. Will be going on to claim their benefits very soon. And Channel 4 this week had a look at the company A4E, which is employed by the government, vast amounts of taxpayers' money. In fact, in total, A4E has received about £46 million from the Department of Work and Pensions. And Channel 4 have found that this company, which helps unemployed people into benefit, has actually not reached any of its targets to actually get people jobs. This particular figure is quite incredible. It says that they were supposed to get at least 5% of the claimants that were sent to them. 93,000 unemployed people have been onto A4E's books, but actually only 4% of them have got it. Now, this is comparing, Martin, this is comparing to the natural amount of people that will be getting jobs anyway. It's actually even worse than the old figures for when the job centres were doing this work rather than A4E. Even less people now are getting into what they call permanent work, which is, I think it's around about 8 months to a year of being in a stable job after coming off benefits. Less people under A4E are getting jobs and keeping them than they were under the old system, which was organised by the Department of Work and Pensions itself.
Well, surely the answer is to stop giving money to A4E, as it must probably the answer is to stop giving money to the banks as well. I mean, basically, large sections of what goes on in British society are actually subsidised by the government, and it's not the parts that people think about. The woman who runs A3, Emma, whatever her name is,
Emma Harrison.
Emma Harrison has become a multimillionaire on the back of this. It's absurd.
Anthony, what are your thoughts about this privatising the job of the job centres used to
I
do
think
this?
Martin's
work.
Is a very fair point, and I have to say on the bald figures that I've seen and read on this, it doesn't look a very good picture for A4E. But I think I think you mentioned the difference between when it was handled by our own job centres and all this, and now it's handled by A4E. I think what we may have seen is a change in the job climate out there. It may well be that there are now less leads out there in the last 18 months since A4E started to get involved in this,
and more Ford workers. More Ford workers looking for
doing it. I'm not trying to, don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to excuse A4E at all, but I think if we were to look at why this may have happened, that's certainly got to be one of the things we should be looking at. That maybe it just that there just aren't the jobs out there to put these people into, and this I have to say is what concerns me about what. In general, I think is a sensible way forward in terms of the way welfare benefits are being reviewed. But it only works. The whole philosophy only works if there are jobs out there for those people who we are trying to get away and off benefits to go into. If those jobs do not exist, then the welfare system, as it's now been reshaped, is actually not going to do any good, and it's certainly on a personal level going to do a great deal of harm.
Well, maybe Emma Harrison will be forced to shut up shop and retire to her mansion, Martin.
Yeah, I think it's very... what Anthony's touching on there is the demand deficiency problem, which we were identifying a moment ago. I think the real problem ultimately is structural unemployment, and the Greens, to be fair, have been banging on about this for a number of years, that ultimately we might have to set up a different kind of welfare system which is based upon a citizen's income. And I know this has been discussed in Liberal Democrat circles as well.
Yes, it is.
And of course it was originally thought of by Milton Friedman, who was thought of as a super right winger. He called it negative income tax. And of course, if you have a citizen's income, and I think Denmark came close to bringing one in the 90s, basically everybody in the country gets a basic income from the government just for being a citizen. And then, of course, that flexibilises the labour market. So if you can get 1 hour's work, you get 1 hour's work. If you get 60 hours work, you get 60 hours work. But, of course, it's a big change in attitude, because you'd have to accept that some people wouldn't work. That's what happens anyway, but you'd have to just accept that. And, you're basically allowing some people, if they don't want to work, if they want to sit writing poetry or whatever, then they can do that. But of course that checks a change of attitude, and I don't think that attitude change will come about until the main system that we've got starts to break down more dramatically. But of course Ian Duncan Smith's universal credit is halfway there to this idea. But of course, we need to start talking seriously now. There's been at least 1 million unemployed throughout my adult lifetime, and I'm 52. There is clearly not enough work to go around, and there hasn't been for a generation.
But Martin, the thing with the universal credit is going to be bedroom taxes, benefit caps, and all sorts of other reasons where people may well have to move because they can't afford to pay rent.
Well, I think I'm not in support of what's going on in Duncan Smith. I'm just saying that the idea of having one universal credit, like a citizen's income, for example, it's a lot easier to administer than the current system. Like housing benefit, for example, every time somebody's wages change because they've worked an extra hour, it all has to be recalculated yet again. And of course, there's a whole bureaucracy of people calculating all of this all the time. If you had one universal citizen's income, then you just get paid that, and that's it. And wealthy people would get it exactly the same as poor people. Nobody could complain that somebody was getting something they didn't.
Okay, yeah. Anthony, do you want to just round up on this?
If I may say so, I mean, it has been a Liberal Democrat policy for a long time to try and make sense out of taking money away from people in certain circumstances and giving it back to people, sometimes I have to say the same people, with a different sort of positive tax and tax credits and everything else. What's I'm not saying that what's coming out of the universal credit is fair or equitable or even charitable, but it is certainly making some sense out of some very, very wacky things that we were doing in the past. And I think in principle it's got some logic behind it. I don't think it's being as helpful as it may be, and it's certainly not as generous as I would like it to be, but I think in principle it is going in sort of in the right direction.
Okay, well, let's hope a little bit of Liberal Democrat spin at Westminster, Anthony, can spin it round onto the right track.
Well, I hope so too.
Severn Bridges toll cut. Hopes have been dashed. Hopes that tolls on the Severn Bridges will be reduced in 2018 when the current private contract runs out appear to have been dashed. Transport Minister Stephen Hammond said he believed there would be no drop in price due to repair costs and the UK government debts on construction. He's been questioned by Welsh MPs about the issue on Tuesday last week. The First Minister in Wales said he hoped the Welsh government would run the bridges and may be able to cut the tolls. And this was discussed by various people on Radio Wales. I didn't hear a lot of bit of discussion of it on here. And here's an extract from an interview which was conducted with Stuart Colner at the University of Glamorgan, and he's a professor of transport there.
The income from the bridge currently is £80 million per annum. The cost of running the bridge is £15 million per annum. So I'm not quite sure how Mr Hammond squares up his numbers there. The second is that when the House of Commons previously looked at the tolls on the bridge, there was a rumour going around that perhaps the income from the bridge would be transferred to the Welsh Government. The Welsh Government would then have the opportunity to decide either to keep the tolls, but more likely to reduce them, because that would make South Wales more attractive for both tourists and inward investors. So that, I think, is a surprise now, that when this concession runs out, it has to run out in 2026, as soon as they reach a total sum of £998 million of income, which is likely to be 2017-2018, then the concession ends and the bridge reverts back to the public sector. And it would either revert back to the Department for Transport or it would revert back to the Welsh Government, one or the other. It's not just the motorists who see this as a cash cow, but the UK Treasury see it as a cash cow, which is probably the main reason why Mr Hammond, or indeed any other minister in London, would say, well, you know, this is going to stay with the Department for Transport. I can't see, without a lot of pressure, the UK Treasury handing over £80 million a year, increasing year by year, of course. It is a guaranteed cash cow. Very few people would make the alternative trip via Chepstow, and so it's an almost guaranteed source of income. If the Welsh Government did take charge of the bridge, could then reduce the charges to one-fifth of what they are now. So for cars it would be £1, for lorries it would be something like £4. That's a much more attractive proposition than what we've got at the moment. There was evidence presented to the committee. It was a bit mixed. Many companies said it did make a difference. It depends, I guess, on how much they paid in tolls. One company I remember giving evidence, Owen's Transport Services from Llanelli, spent several hundred thousand pounds a year on these tolls, and clearly that makes an impact on their ability to be competitive with companies from the other side of Offa's Dyke.
Well, that's the other side of Offa's Dyke. There are voices from the other side of Offa's Dyke there. Some fascinating figures have come out in this debate. One is this business of it costs around about £18 million a year to run the bridge, and the amount of money coming in is £80 million a year in tolls. Martin, it does seem that even though the entire money several times would have been paid back to build it, that there's a kind of reluctance to hand this back, this piece of road. And the tolls now are really very, very expensive. The other thing, of course, is there's not a lot of real accounting goes on up there. You don't get a receipt. Most of the time you just go and chuck your cash in. It does seem, by the way, I invite the Severn Toll Bridge on to do an interview to contribute to this, but they didn't get back to me. That this seems to be just a bit of a racket, basically, running over the backwards and forwards across to Wales, and many companies are paying an absolute fortune.
Well, it's what we do in Britain, isn't it? We profiteer off the infrastructure, which actually undermines your actual export industries. We did it with the railways. I mean, I know the Isle of Skye Bridge, that was built by the private sector and they wanted tolls on it, and as soon as Scotland got devolution, they took it into the public sector. But what's interesting about that is that people didn't know what the deal was. Some of these deals that are done with private companies are commercially confidential, even though public resources are committed to them.
Anthony?
Well, I don't know that I've got a lot to add to this as it stands, but I would like to perhaps put a different gloss to it. I mean, the other big thing that's sort of sloshing around in between Bristol and Wales is the barrage which has popped up again. Recently, with Peter Hain and David Cavern giving it some room to talk about it, I wonder if there isn't some desire to keep hold of this in order to also control or have some influence on what goes on in the River Severn. That there's so much opportunity in the Severn with tidal energy. It's a massive opportunity, and the barrage is absolutely not the way to do it. There are a number of different technologies which could actually be interwoven, which could actually be used together with the ability to use it as a living testbed, making energy cheaply, using as a living testbed which we can then export to other parts of the world. This is a wonderful potential for us down here, and I don't want government to try and slide a barrage in through the back door by holding on to the reins of the bridge tolls and controlling those bridges. I think we've got so much opportunity, not just in expertise, but in terms of potential jobs, in terms of being a really big place in the UK, indeed in Europe, to actually be a centre of excellence for producing tidal power and green, really very huge lumps of green energy.
Okay,
and
Anthony,
we don't want to waste that chance.
Anthony, I'm going to have to ask you though, why are we paying £6 on the toll when we should be only paying a pound?
Well, the answer is we shouldn't. But that's, I mean, Martin said that's the way government worked with infrastructure. It worked with the Channel Tunnel. It works with so many other things that once having got something in place, then it's used as a cash cow for a very, very long time. But I think there's something more than that. Simply behind this particular thing, I think the government are trying to swing something into the Severn with all the environmental damage they could do, and I'm very worried about it.
Well, maybe we should have a few forces from Cardiff on one end of the bridge and some from Bristol on this side of the bridge, and see if we can twist a few arms of the Severn Crossing Company to have a realistic toll, because at the moment you don't really have much of a choice. Anyway, we're coming up now to the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock. Thanks very much to this week's guest, who was on the phone there, Lib Dem Councillor for Cotton and Cabinet Member for Housing, Anthony Negus.
Thank you.
This is BCFM 93.2, the community station for Bristol. Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky News Centre.